What if they had messed up? It would have been Vic Morrow, Twilight Zone all over the place, decapitations and blood. And the crowd rightfully hated that because they had nowhere to run. That operation was the moral equivalent of shooting fish in a barrel. And that is not the nature or the soul of the professionals who are in the police department. There has been a great abuse committed against the police in this city, and that abuse was done by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. He is the greatest cop hater in New York today, by putting them in jeopardy, by transferring to them the resentment that people seeking their freedom have. Police do not rule by military force. They do not rule by the gun. They rule by trust. And for all of the corrupt and evil and venal individuals that may be among the police, for every one of those, there's a number more who might be assumed to try to do the job they took an oath to do. That trust has been destroyed by Mayor Giuliani and by his puppet, Howdy Doody Safer. People want to put it all on Khalid Muhammad, on Alid Muhammad. No. The attack on the community came from the police. But the attack on the police came from the mayor, not from the people. Just wanted to say that. I'm sure there's going to be a lot to talk about. Thank you for listening. You can be in touch by calling 209. I've been Robert Knight. Thank you also, Dr. Carrie Mullis, for an extraordinary interview and an extraordinary book. It's called Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, published by Pantheon Press. Take a look at it. See you next week and tomorrow. Not to walk alone. I was waiting for the good Samaritan, but waiting was hopeless. It was all in vain. The Ku Klux Klan, but you get to holler and die for. Them not let me go now. Oh no, one nigger, the less, the better the show. Dance, jump, black skin, and take your role.
And that program was brought to you on recording. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we are going to hear a segment of a previous New York Review of Science Fiction readings, a special event we had with Skyboat Media, and of course, first, a review.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There are a couple of interesting ironies that come with the new film The Giver if you know enough about the work of its director, Philip Noyce. Noyce's career is wide and diverse. He's best known probably for such gritty espionage films as Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, and The Quiet American. But within that resume are a couple of lesser-known and very excellent social dramas. Rabbit Proof Fence, a period piece set in 1931 Australia about three Aboriginal girls who escape from a training camp and try to find their way home, and Catch a Fire, a true story set in apartheid-era South Africa about a black man who becomes a terrorist after his mistreatment at the hands of the all-white police force. Both great films, both worth checking out. The smaller irony is that significant portions of The Giver were shot in South Africa, so clearly no hard feelings there. More interesting is that for a director who has frequently created compelling dramas about the struggle for racial equality, The Giver may be the whitest film of the year. I only came to this realization late in the film, but I am fairly certain that, save for a variety of quick flash montage sequences that show an Earth before a non-specific apocalypse sets the stage for this particular story, there is not one non-Caucasian face in the entire film. At the very least, that's certainly true among the main cast. And the thing is, not only do I feel that this is not accidental, at least not in the customary, whoops, we just forgot that there are talented black actors out there way that still happens too frequently in the film and TV industry. It actually follows through on Noyce's history with racially aware drama. In The Giver's post-apocalyptic world, true equality has been attained essentially by tamping down all differences and anything that essentially defines the human condition. Emotions are chemically excised, lying is outlawed, and an antiseptic adherence to precision in thought, word, and deed is imposed. Thus, the numbing uniformity of skin color, drabness underlined by large portions of the film being presented in black and white, which, as it is slowly revealed, is less a stylistic touch on Noyce's part and actually supposed to be the way the characters perceive their world. But the main character of The Giver, a teenager named Jonas, played by Brenton Thwaites, whom we last saw in a small role in Maleficent, is about to find out that this is not the only way of seeing the world. He's been assigned by his community to become a receiver, a walking repository of human history before the world reached this dystopically paradisiacal turn. To do this, he's apprenticed to the Giver, played by Jeff Bridges, an aged recluse who lives outside the community and their restrictions in a book-lined redoubt, and who telepathically transfers the thoughts, feelings, triumphs, and atrocities of true humanity to his young charge. It's a dangerous process, not just because of the potential psychic damage that might be inflicted with the revelation of the true cost for complete equality, including some nasty little secrets about what happens to keep this community at its most efficient population, but also because the Giver may have plans for his apprentice that fall far outside his archival mandate. The Giver is based on a series of much-beloved YA books written by Lois Lowry. Their popularity is news to me. Sorry, I kind of stopped at A Wrinkle in Time. So even though I haven't read them, I am presuming that the wider canvas a novel-length tale can provide would help better set the conditions under which the Giver and Jonas could get away with the things they do within this tightly controlled society. And length may also explain the problems during the film's final act, during which Jonas undertakes a lone odyssey through a banned territory. In theory, this should be a point of self-discovery for the character, when all of the experiences he previously received telepathically are now made tangible. Noyce, who, as noted before, is no stranger to tales of people calling upon stores of untapped strength to fight soul-crushing societal injustices, applies his considerable talents to conveying this emotional journey. But it still feels somewhat curtailed, and the story feels a bit lopsided because of it. And despite those problems, this is still a beautifully told and emotionally rich parable of what it means to be human and what we lose when we fail to accept humanity in all its glories and flaws. It's a tall order to sum up such concepts in not quite 2 hours, and The Giver doesn't always stick the landing, but it hits often enough to make this a thrilling and, yeah, memorable experience. I'm Dan Persons. We are now archiving these reviews at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please be sure to check out Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. That was actually like the first review I've heard of The Giver that made it sound interesting to me, but what can I say? This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program, Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. The Hugo Awards were held this past weekend. This is the fan-issued award that determines excellence in science fiction and fantasy. This is as opposed to the Nebulas, which is a peer award voted by members of the science fiction writers, science fiction and fantasy writers community, as opposed to the World Fantasy Award, which A, does more or less stick to fantasy, and B, is a juried award. So they're all different views. But the Hugo is probably the best known. And I have not made secret of the fact that I have very happily been involved in editing, doing the post-production, and hosting of late Lightspeed Magazine's podcast. And I wasn't even thinking about what was going on, other than I saw some posts from the people that I work with. They are out in L.A., Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure. And they had a table representing Skyboat Media, their production company. And all of a sudden, I start getting some emails on late Sunday afternoon. A couple of them were, congratulations. Hey, heard your name from the stage. It's like, what? Well, apparently Lightspeed Magazine won the Hugo for best semi-prozine. I don't know exactly which the best prozine is nowadays. I missed that. There are a lot of Hugo Awards, and some other time maybe we'll go through what won this year. You know that Gravity won for best movie, and an episode of Game of Thrones, there were two nominated, beat out the three Doctor Who episodes that were nominated, and Anne Leckie won for her debut novel. But we won for semi-prozine. Now, it's funny. I'm working on the podcast, and yes, I'm hired by John Joseph Adams, who is the editor of Lightspeed Magazine. But for the most part, I work with the Skyboat Media people because they do the recordings that come to me. I then edit them. Mix the music by Jack Kincaid into the podcast, and I am the host. By the way, if you want to hear any of these, now, after this show, after, you know, at some point you're not listening to WBAI, of course, you can go to lightspeedmagazine.com. It's all free, although you can subscribe to the ebook and blah, 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 blah. Listen to the podcast, the outro of the podcast, mellifluously announced by myself, and we'll tell you more about that. So, Stefan and Gabrielle were the representatives, and they got up and won the Hugo Award, and they gave a lovely speech, and oh my God, I was mentioned in that. So I feel like I, too, share with them on the... technically, it's John Joseph Adams, Rich Horton, and Stefan Rudnicki who are the real recipients of the award. But, you know, we're all one family. Like when you see the Tony Awards and they announce the best play or musical and thousands of people stream up on stage. That certainly was true for Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, I believe is the title, where there were, you know, something like, you know, 50 producers. Anyway. Wayback Machine, just a bit to May, late May of this year, and the Book Expo of America was at the Javits Center. At the same time, the Audi Awards, that's A-U-D-I-E, were being given out for audiobooks and narrators and stuff like that. And Stefan Rudnicki was nominated for a book by Alex Bledsoe, and in fact, won. The following day, we put together a special edition of the New York Review of Science Fiction. We had done that in advance on a Friday evening, rather unusual for us. And I rented out a space at great expense, by the way, because our normal space was not available. And I was really looking forward to a huge crowd of people. And it was mortifying. It was mortifying. We had maybe a dozen folk in the room, which is a shame because it was a wonderful event. Well, you are going to get to hear most of that event right now. And I promise them, don't worry about the lack of people in the room. I will get you thousands. And lo and behold, here you are. Thank you for coming to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Let me give you the bios. First of all, Skyboat Media. Gotta mention that we've been on summer vacation for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, but that's coming to an end September 9th, the second Tuesday. Usually we're the first Tuesday, but we wanted to not have the reading the day after Memorial Day. And because it's not the first Tuesday, once again, we will not be at the Soho Gallery for digital art. Instead, I am renting space outside of Manhattan for the first time, for September 9th, at the Commons in Brooklyn at 388 Atlantic Avenue. What? Says the WBAI listener. that address is familiar. Well, yeah. You see, the BAI offices, not our studios, the offices are on the third floor of that building. But this is the ground floor, and by the way, is wheelchair accessible. So, do we have anybody good? Yeah. Two writers. A science fiction writer who writes mysteries by the name of Paul DiFilippo, and a mystery writer who writes brilliant science fiction, Walter Mosley. Good enough for you? Tuesday, September 9th, admission is free, donations accepted, 388 Atlantic Avenue. We open the doors at 6:30. Okay, so this one was late May of this year, and the participants are Stefan Rutnicki, Gabrielle DeCure, and in the first half they will read, and in the second half you will hear them interviewed by Amy Goldschlager. And first I will give you their bios, the audiobook people's bios. Stefan Rutnicki has produced, directed, and or executive produced nearly 3,000 audiobooks for Skyboat Audio and major publishers including Audible.com, Blackstone Audio, Dove Audio, Macmillan Audio, Random House Audio Publishing Group, and Zondervan. Not Zondervan Audio. He has narrated hundreds of audiobooks, including multiple titles by Orson Scott Card, the Ender's Game series, Charles McCary, Ben Bova, Alan Dean Foster, the Pip and Flinks books, which are a lot of fun, by the way, David Weber, John Ringo, and Greg Bear, Matthew Stover, Gregory Benford, Gordon R. Dixon, and Frederick Brown. Stefan has won 2 Grammy Awards, as well as the Ray Bradbury Award, the Bram Stoker Prize, and multiple Audie Awards for works by Harlan Ellison, Orson Scott Card, and others. His solo narration of Alex Bledsoe's Wisp of a Thing, it says here, is an Audie finalist. No, won the Audie this year, in addition to Skyboat Media's Ender's Game Alive, which was a finalist in 3 categories, including Distinguished Achievement in Production. Stefan is a 3-time Hugo nominee and, of course, as of this last Sunday, a Hugo Award winner. Gabrielle DeCure has narrated over 100 titles specializing in fantasy, humor, and titles requiring extensive foreign language and accent skills. She has narrated Ursula K. Le Guin, Gregory Benson, Ben Bova, and Orson Scott Card. She is the director mastermind behind the dramatization of Ender's Game Alive. She produced Jonathan Mayberry's V-Wars on audio and just completed directing Will Wheaton narrating Cory Doctorow's Homeland. She is, quote, she hijacked June's issue of Lightspeed magazine by producing all the podcasts in the Women Destroy Science Fiction anniversary issue with Christy Ant and Mer Lafferty, who took over from me as host for that month, although I still got to do the post-production. So, we are now going to hear the first half of that event, and then we will take a brief break and hear the interview conducted by Amy Goldschlager. So set your Wayback Machine for May 30th of this year to 440 Lafayette Street, third floor.
I'm going to kick things off. I will kick things off with a bit of a warm-up. How many of you have heard of Lewis Shiner? That's not bad. That's almost half the room. Lewis Shiner is a terrific multi-genre writer, and we've been communicating very nicely for some years. I've recorded several of his books, including his collected stories recently for Blackstone Audio. I'm going to kick things off with this little story that will set the tone, I think. His girlfriend's dog. One day he saw himself the way his girlfriend's dog saw him. Huge, slow, precariously built, insensitive to moods and hungers and smells, overly fastidious about privates and dung. Soon he found his girlfriend incomprehensible, perhaps even cruel. Her actions seemed deliberately meant to puzzle him. His sense of play offended her. After they broke up, she would call him. "Ernie misses you," she would say. "What about you?" "Of course not," she would say, confusing him yet again. "He sees me every day."
I've had a brain crush on James Patrick Kelly from the first time that I read one of his stories. This particular one, I'm going to do the beginning for you, is called Candy Art. I optioned it for a film, which hasn't come to be yet, but Jim's talent of blending drama and character with story, I just find absolutely delightful. This is Candy Art by James Patrick Kelly. So, I beat my boyfriend Mel, who hasn't been a boy since television died and ought to be more than a friend by now, since for the last 5 years we've shared an apartment and a bed and a dreamscape. I tell him the news about my parents. They want a what? It's 4:13 in the afternoon, and Mel is downtown in the glorified closet he calls his candy lab. His hair's in a bird's nest that somebody stepped on, and he sounds as if he's just woken up. "Move back in," I said. "With me. Us." "They're uploads, Jennifer." When I first met Mel, I thought the sleepy voice was sexy. How can they move in with us when they're not anywhere anymore? "They bought a puppet to live in," I say. "It's life-sized, new skin, real speak, top of the line. It's supposed to be my Christmas present. Bring the family back together for the holidays and live unhappily ever after." "A puppet?" A puzzlement glyph pops up at the bottom of my screen. "As in one puppet?" "It's a timeshare, you know? They live it serially. 10 hours for him, 14 for her." "Not 50-50? Oh, he's giving her the difference so he can take extra time off for his bass tournament in June. When Mel reaches off screen, I am certain that he's about to click off. His typical reaction to bad news is to hide. Instead, he produces one of his favorite cinnamon stripe pineapple liquixes and peels the wrapper. "How long are they going to stay?" "They didn't say." "Probably forever." He waves the liquix under his nose and sniffs. "With our luck, yeah." He isn't expecting me to agree. "You could tell them no." The panic glyph starts to brink. "Mel." "Why, it's your life." He pops the liquix into his mouth and twirls it. "My life," I want to screech. "My life is putting up with a psychotically bashful candy artist for all this time with nothing to show for it but a sweet tooth and dirty towels. I am 42 wasted years old, and not only am I currently sleeping with a flab bucket who samples as much product as he ships, but now my dead parents are going to be meddling with my pathetic life 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 bleeding blue days a year. But I don't. Instead, I say, "But Mel, sweetie, it's their apartment."
Love that story.
Deals with the social issue of taking care of parents, which I like.
Speaking of Alex Bledsoe, which Jim was earlier, in relation to last night's awards, the book that that award was for was his eighth that I've recorded, and it was the second in a relatively new series, his mainstream series, which is about the Tufa, a tribe of people who live somewhere in the backwoods of Appalachia, and who have some strange habits, among them the habit of making fantastic music. I am not going to read a section from that book or either one of those in that series. His other main series, not quite as mainstream, is the Eddie LaCrosse thrillers. Eddie LaCrosse is a sword jockey. This is in a world of swords and sorcery, though most people don't believe in sorcery. There is some in this world. And Eddie's a kind of a private eye. He goes around from place to place, and he solves mysteries, and he's a guy for hire, a sword for hire. His most recent book, that is Alex Bledsoe's most recent book, is the fifth in that series, called He Drank and Saw the Spider. And there will be a pop quiz afterwards. What dramatic work do you think this novel is based on or inspired by? This is the first part of chapter one, sort of get you into the story, and if you like it, get the audiobook. Part one, Isidore, chapter one. The battles had been hard, the gold had been scarce, and the company, other than mercenaries like me, most of them older, all of them unsophisticated as bricks, had gotten on my nerves. So I deserted, or as we called it in the trade, chose to pursue other opportunities. That was the whole point of hiring out your sword arm instead of actually joining an army, wasn't it? I was a young man that summer, long-haired, beardless, and still hiding behind a mercenary's blade from the truth about myself and my past. There wasn't a tavern which I hadn't known, a farm girl I hadn't tried to know, or a noble lady I hadn't considered getting to know. I drank often, ate whatever came my way, and took what I needed when no one was looking. I was Eddie LaCrosse, no longer Edward, the heir to the LaCrosse barony in Arentia, and I went where the wars were. Unless, of course, the war turned out to be boring. And that's how I ended up in an Alturan forest just below the mountain foothills, minding my own business and pissing on a tree when a man entered the clearing screaming and running for his life. A moment later, he exited, pursued by a bear. I fastened my pants and took off after him on foot, knowing my horse was useless in the undergrowth. Over the past 16 years, I've often wondered why I did that. I was all business in those days, and business meant gold. I wanted to sign up with the Alturan army, then about to go to war with its neighbor Nanoma and its paranoid king Gerald. But instead of sticking to my plan, I ran to help a stranger without even a second thought. I suppose I believed there might be a reward for rescuing him. Yeah, that must have been it. The man's screams and the bear's roars made them easy to find, but by the time I reached the top of a ridge and looked down into the little gully, it was too late. The bear had him. He lay beneath the beast, curled into a ball, face down on the ground, screaming as the great claws sliced into his unprotected back. The animal bellowed and snapped, trying to get a clean bite on the man's head. No thought went into my next decision either. I drew my sword, held it like a dagger, and jumped down onto the bear's back. I put all my weight and momentum behind the weapon, which struck the animal's shoulder blade, slid off the bone, and buried itself to the hilt in the furry body. The bear was a monster, easily 600 pounds. And when it reared up in response to my stab, clamped my heels against its sides and clung onto the sword hilt with all the strength my terror suddenly gave me. The great claws swiped the air overhead, splattering me with blood and bits of the man's flesh. "Run!" I yelled to the man on the ground, but he remained curled up, protecting his belly at the expense of his flayed-open back. The bear stumbled backwards, still upright, and slammed into the nearest tree. 600 pounds in motion can do some serious slamming, and my lungs emptied under the pressure. Little flashes sparkled at the edges of my vision. My legs slipped free and flailed in the air. I knew if I lost my grip on my sword, I was done for. So I held on despite everything, twisting the hilt and wrenching the blade as much as possible in search of some vital organ. "Run, will ya?" I yelled again. Finally, I hit something essential, because with a combination roar and wheeze, the bear fell forward and hit the ground. The impact tossed me over its shoulder into the leaves beside its victim. I lay there and waited for my lungs to refill. The bear did not move, which was good because I was out of juice. At last, I could breathe and got to my knees. "Dude, you need to be..." The man I'd failed to save was still alive, his eyes wide and staring, but the bubble of blood between his lips told me he wasn't good for long. I said, "Don't move. You're really hurt." He rolled himself over onto his ragged back. I winced at how much of his insides fell out through wide gaps as he did so. I wasn't squeamish. I'd gutted my share of people. But there was something grotesque about it, and it made my stomach knot. Faster than I would have thought possible in his condition, he grabbed my tunic and slapped the edge of a dagger against my neck. "Take her," he said. I looked down at the bundle now resting on his chest. The bundle that he'd given his liver and big loops of his intestines to protect. A bundle that was moving. A tiny pink fist emerged. A baby. From inside the bundle came an annoyed wailing cry. The man's eyes met mine as he finished. "Somewhere safe." I knew it. I knew I should at least pick up the child from his bloody chest, but I hesitated. Man-killing bears were one thing, but a baby was something far outside my experience. I had no brothers or sisters. And my friends back in Orentia were all about my own age. If they had infant siblings, we never had to deal with them. "Look, pal," I started. "Take her," he said, half spoken and half gurgled. He dropped the knife and tried to hand her to me, but he lacked the strength. "Let's just get you patched up, okay?" I said quickly, knowing it was futile. He shook his head. Now he was bleeding from his nostrils. Overhead, an opportunistic crow announced the man's imminent death to its murder mates. "Please save her, she's..." He sucked in a deep breath, and his whole body went rigid from the waves of pain hitting all at once. There was no escaping it. So I took the bundle with all the grace of a man fondling his worst enemy's testicles. I pulled back one corner of the blood-spattered blanket, revealing tiny pink feet. Then I reversed the bundle, opened that end, and saw the baby's small rubbery features. The man slapped another bundle into my hand. This one was smaller, with the distinctive metallic sound of coins. Then he gestured me close.
Her name is Isidore. Please save her.
I will, I said. What else could I say?
Take this,
he said, and fumbled in the bloody folds of his clothes.
It proves who she...
He produced a small glass ball that glowed icy blue from inside. I'd never seen anything like it, or at that point in my life, anything I would accept as real, genuine magic. Because I was so startled, I didn't reach for it, and then the man's whole body spasmed with pain. The ball fell from his hand to the forest floor, where it burst like a soap bubble and turned into a fine grayish powder that disappeared.
She belongs to...
Then he died. I sat there beside him for a long time, holding the tiny girl, who seemed quite content for the moment. When I tickled her under her chin, she laughed. But I knew she'd need something to eat soon, and I was no wet nurse. How had her guardian managed? I checked and found a small ale-skin bag on his belt, and when I sniffed it, it had the distinctive odor of milk. I hated to leave him to the mercy of the forest scavengers, but I was sure he'd understand. The living took precedence over the dead, and the flies were already thick in the air. There's a good girl, Isidore. Let's go get my horse, and then find you a home. She cooed, and damn it, I fell in love a little.
You want to give a little history of Honeymoon in Hell?
Yeah. When I was somewhere between the ages of 11 and 14, I was twice a week swinging by a local candy store, what they used to call them then. It had a soda fountain. You could get egg creams. This was back in Queens. And they had a paperback rack. And every week there would be something new in there. Every week, believe it or not. And one of my favorite writers back in those days was Frederick Brown. And any new thing that came out, I'd grab. And in those days, it was 35 cents. It was no longer a quarter, but it was 35 cents. Fred was usually published by Bantam. And remember that little cock in the corner there? And Honeymoon in Hell is a collection of his stories that I read somewhere around the time I was 12 or 13. And it had a profound influence. When you're that age, everything you read, first of all, you haven't read as much as you will later. So everything you read that has any kind of impact at all has greater impact. And I remember those stories inside out to this day. When Gabrielle and I began launching our publishing initiative with Skyboat Media, I said, I gotta get Frederick Brown. In fact, I'd been looking for the rights holder, for some representative of the estate, some executor, for about 6 or 7 years, and even Harlan Ellison couldn't tell me who that was. Didn't know. Through an odd set of circumstances, I found out that it was another science fiction writer whom I then met and discussed, and I got the rights to this, and so far three others of Frederick Brown's books. We've recorded Honeymoon in Hell. It's been released. It was released in March at Blackstone. You can get it on Downpour and whatnot. And this is one of my favorite stories from it, which was also included in my anthology of women's monologues.
Are Austin Wilkinson was a bon vivant. Man about Manhattan and chaser of women. He was also an incorrigible punster on every possible occasion. In speaking of his favorite activity, for example, he would remark that he was a wolf, as it were, but that didn't make him a werewolf. Excruciating as this statement may have been to some of his friends, it was almost true. Wilkinson was not a werewolf. He was a were-buck. A night or two nights every week, he would stroll into Central Park, turn himself into a buck, and take great delight in running and playing. True, there was always danger of his being seen, but since he punned even in his thoughts, he was willing to gamble on that. Oddly, it had never occurred to him to combine the pleasures of being a wolf, as it were, with the pleasures of being a buck. Until one night. Why, he asked himself that night, couldn't a lucky buck make a little doe? Once thought of, the idea was irresistible. He galloped to the wall of Central Park Zoo and trotted along it until his sensitive buck nose told him he'd found the right place to climb the fence. He changed into a man for the task of climbing, and then, alone in a pen with a beautiful doe, he changed himself back into a buck. She was sleeping. He nudged her gently and whispered a suggestion. Her eyes opened wide and startled. No, no, a dozen times no. Only a dozen times? He asked, and then he leered. My dear, he whispered, think of the fawn we'll have. Which went too far. He might have got away with it had his deer really been only a doe, but she was a were-maid, a doe who could change into a girl, and she was a witch as well. She quickly changed into a girl and ran for the fence. When he changed into a man and started after her, she threw a spell over her shoulder, a spell that turned him back to a buck and froze him that way. Do you ever visit the Central Park Zoo? Look for the buck with the sad eyes. He's Wilkinson. He is sad despite the fact that the doe were-maid, who is now the toast of New York ballet, she's graceful as a deer, the critics say, visits him occasionally by night and resumes her proper form. But when he begs for release from the spell, she only smiles sweetly and tells him no, that she is of a very saving disposition and wants to keep the first buck she ever made.
May I point out, if you did that off book, you'd know it by cart.
Cart, yes. Nice job.
Lovely. That
we're going to leave you with puns, yes.
Our reading portion, yeah. Brown is amazing. He can be profound. He can be profoundly funny. He can be creepy as hell, and sometimes all in the same story. It's very, very cool stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. And my name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. And what we are listening to is an episode, if you will, a performance at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings just this past May. ill attended there, but hopefully well attended here on the radio. You see, what we didn't take into account, as I mentioned, this was the week that BEA, the Book Expo of America, was in New York. But the people that would have come to see Stefan Rudnicki and Gabriel DeCure perform were, aside from the usual skiffy people, the science fiction people, were at various parties related to Book Expo, and the audiobook people had all left town. The Audi Awards, for which Stefan won for Alex Bledsoe's book, as I mentioned earlier, the Audi Awards were given out on Thursday, and to save money, you know, weekend rates, everybody, all the audiobook people deserted New York. So we had an underwhelming attendance, but nevertheless, a good time was had, and I hope that you're enjoying it and hearing it. We are about to hear 36 more minutes of this event, which really consists of an interview conducted by Amy Goldschlager. But first, just mentioning, you're probably surprised I haven't mentioned Doctor Who. Well, Doctor Who. Now I've mentioned it. I've seen a preview of the first episode. It is a lot of fun. I like Peter Capaldi as the new Doctor. I have not watched the full second episode, but I got to tell you, the opening sequence up to the credits are exceedingly worthwhile. Now, they are showing this in movie theaters. They're going to capitalize on this anyway and every way they possibly can. Don't do it, for a very simple, very basic reason. Peter Capaldi is keeping the Scots accent, something that David Tennant did not. David Tennant went British for his Doctor, for the 10th Doctor. But for this, the 12th Doctor, this is pretty darned Scot. And, you know, not just Sean Connery, Scott. This is the real thing. Closed captioning is advised. So we're going to go now to the second half of that event. And again, I should mention that it is Stefan Rudnicki and Gabriel DeCure that produce the podcasts that I edit and host for Lightspeed Magazine, which won the Hugo Award this past Sunday. So we are all exceedingly proud, along with the editor, John Joseph Adams, and the reprint rights editor, Rich Horton, and Stefan is in charge of choosing the